Hello, 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 and welcome to the Local Edition on Radio Catskill, your NPR station for the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm your host for this Tuesday evening, Patricio Roballo. In the second half of our program, we'll be talking to Meg McGuire. She's the publisher of the Delaware Currents. Recently, Meg McGuire co-hosted the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference with the University of Pennsylvania. The conference brings more than 1,000 environmental journalists under one roof. We'll find out what happened at this event. But first, the Hudson Valley cannabis industry is gathering on April 25th for the Spring Hudson Valley Cannabis Roll Call and Supply Chain Spotlight event. This inaugural event will be a cannabis networking, insight sharing, and connection that will spotlight businesses up and down the local cannabis supply chain in the Hudson Valley. The event is hosted by Season Gives and Hemp Humanity and will be in Milton, New York. On the phone with us now is Executive Director for Season Gives, Tamika Dunkley. Tamika, welcome to the program.
Hi, and thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we go into the details of exactly what's happening on April 25th, can you tell us more about Season Gives and what is your mission?
Season Gives is a 501c3 organization in Lake Katrine. We have a 10,000 square foot incubator facility, and we do workforce development and entrepreneurship training mainly for women and people of color. We don't refuse anybody, and we want everybody to come and participate, but we focus on the most underserved and marginalized, historically marginalized communities. And our mission is to create lasting solutions to poverty, hunger, and social injustice through education, ownership, and self-sufficiency. So we do a lot.
How did your organization come to host this type of event for cannabis and get involved with the Hudson Valley cannabis industry?
Yeah, when legalization came about, we were advocating for equity in the legalization of cannabis. And so what that meant for us is those who were most marginalized and historically targeted for during the war on drugs, they would then have an opportunity to create a legal business. Because let's face it, even if you were doing something illicitly, it was still a business. It just wasn't done in the proper way.
One of the things that made New York unique in the rollout of recreational cannabis was that thing you just said, that they reached out to those who have been marginalized, who have been affected by the war on drugs, and give them sort of a chance to be one of the first in line to receive a license to start their own business. But what I've heard in news reports and folks who have talked to us here on the show is that it seems like there were a lot of barriers to achieve that in reality. And it sort of prevented a lot of folks from even making the first step because of some of the demands the state was asking for of them. Is that true in your findings?
Oh, 1,000%. So, and it goes back to the work that we really do and we believe in it with Season Gives. So the reality is that, you know, most people of color don't have access to certain things, especially funding, venture capital. You know, the banking industry is pretty much out in terms of being able to access any type of lines of credit to get startup funds. And cannabis industry killer is a very cash heavy industry to break through and break into. So if you don't have friends and family, which most don't, how are you going to be able to fund a startup business in this industry? That's the first challenge. And the second challenge is also understanding the systems, the processes, all of the documents that are needed. If you don't have the right team in place, it can become very extractive. And we've dealt with entrepreneurs who have been completely extracted. And if they hadn't found us, one was going to end up paying over $100,000 just to apply for a license. So with Season Gives, we provide the technical assistance, one-on-one mentorship, as well as, you know, the pipeline to correct information and help folks to navigate this very cash-heavy and extractive industry.
So that sort of leads into my next question. So what are some of the big challenges that are facing the Hudson Valley cannabis industry right now?
Knowing who to talk to, and that's kind of what brought us, Melissa, who is my co-founder, and I together, is, you know, really understanding the lay of the land is half the battle sometimes when it comes to being an entrepreneur. It's not necessarily what you know, it's who you know. And so we have been able to boast one of the most successful local, you know, industry supply mixers in the Hudson Valley, which is many times the forgotten space and place, but has so many incredible, amazing entrepreneurs within it that have to go either to the capital region or to New York City to be able to do business. And that shouldn't be. We are, you know, the Hudson Valley is a very unique space, but we sometimes are an hour away from each other and don't know that anybody else exists. And so it just is meant to shorten the gap, decrease the silos, and encourage economic prosperity for all business owners in this area.
So you're bringing everyone under one roof, everyone in the industry that's in the Hudson Valley under one roof, so they can network, sort of share experiences, meet other people who are in this industry, maybe sharing the same challenges that they are facing. So let's talk more about what's going to happen on April 25th at this event, the Hudson Valley Roll Call and Supply Spotlight event.
Yeah, so this is a very unique event for us because typically we do it at our incubator space in Lake Katrine at the Seasoned Evolution Center. So we're changing it up. We're taking the show on the road a little bit to go to Hepworth, who is not only one of the folks who have been a stakeholder in this area for a lot of producers and manufacturers, but are able to grow cannabis themselves. And so the spotlight is really to showcase or folks who don't typically have that opportunity to speak about their business, whether it's an ancillary or a direct plant touching business, and how it can really just incentivize folks to do business with other folks. Because when you do these supply chain workshops and everybody has their booth and they're stuck at their booth typically. And so for this, they'll be able to all have an opportunity to talk to everybody. And that's a very unique feature that we're excited to bring.
Reading the press release, one of the things that sort of stood out to me was the Take the Mic Spotlight. Can you talk more about this, exactly this particular aspect of the event, and exactly how will this help and how this will help people make new connections?
Yeah, and it just goes into what I was saying, where people are not, you know, they're used to having very intimate conversations one-on-one if somebody happens to pass by their booth, but they'll be able to, as a group, everybody is going to go to all of the producers, all the manufacturers, all of the ancillary businesses and learn about how it can potentially integrate with their business. So they'll have that little 60-second, here's your time to shine pitch. And then afterwards, people will be able to network and talk to who they're most interested in by a priority. But it'll allow everybody to get the same information all at once.
Getting everyone under the same roof to sort of talk to each other instead of being all spread out throughout the state.
Exactly. And not be clicky, because there's a lot of clicks, you know, just like in any business, you know, networking event, you find your people. But this will really encourage people to talk to people who they haven't interacted with before.
Who should be going to this event? Who is this event? Who do you envision being at this event? You talked about manufacturers and growers, or also those who are maybe interested in looking into getting into the cannabis business should be attending this event?
Yeah, it's growers, it's manufacturers, it's people who are even have ancillary, you know, people who do labeling, people who do marketing, people who do accounting, people who do business consulting, specifically for the cannabis industry. And I was just having this conversation very recently with somebody. You know, the cannabis industry has its own set of rules and regs. So there's entrepreneurship, right? And then there's cannabis entrepreneurship. And so the regulations and the nuances, just even in packaging, if you don't know what you're doing, you are more than likely going to be out of compliance. And you just don't want to have problems with the state. That's not, you know, we just don't want those types of issues. And so it's very important to find people who are studying this, are staying up with the ever-changing shifts in laws and regulations. And, you know, all of us are able to grow together. And because, you know, the Hudson Valley is really a space where it can be this booming industry. And this is a very unique place where we are not having these conversations intentionally many times because we don't even know where to go or who to go to. So this is a unique and very beautiful event.
Yeah, and Sullivan County just recently opened up one of the first dispensaries in Rock Hill, New York. So I talked to other people in the past about, you know, like we have now, we have wine tours, we have wine and beer events here in Sullivan County, that maybe in the near future we will have sort of cannabis festival, cannabis tours, much like we have the wine tours, all the, you know, festivals that are evolve around alcohol.
We will, actually. We are going to have a Hudson Valley showcase at the Caribbean Carnival in Saugerties. So this will be open for everybody, for not just the business owners. So yes, eventually it will take place, but I believe that it's actually going to happen. It is going to happen in Saugerties, where people are going to be able to go and attend. And we will have a licensed dispensary there, as well as lots of education for everybody.
So if someone is listening to this who's in this industry or wants to be part of the industry, how can they attend this event?
Yeah, so if you go to HudsonValleyCannabisRollCall.com, you'll find more information. Again, that's HudsonValleyCannabisRollCall.com. That is the best way to, you can send messages and or email us or, you know, register for the event. All are welcome. Even if you're thinking about getting into the cannabis industry, there is still room. And so this is a really great way for folks who are thinking about it to learn more from folks who are in the cannabis industry right now.
What is the future? Where do you go from here with the Hudson Valley cannabis rollout?
Oh, you know, we would love to take the show on the road and highlight many of the different dispensaries and the amazing manufacturers. Micro business licenses are now coming out. And so being able to kind of travel and allow people from, you know, Sullivan County, like you said, and Dutchess County and Orange County and Greene County to be highlighted and showcased. Like, this is not a one and done event, you know. Make sure to highlight as many amazing entrepreneurs in cannabis as possible. And then you never know. You never know what'll come after that. You know, we have a following. You know, we average about 100 to 125 entrepreneurs at any given networking event, which we're very proud of. And so it's a space for people to make meaningful connections, and that's key.
Tamika, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on? Do you want folks to know about?
Join us on the 25th if you're interested in becoming a part of the cannabis industry or you are a part of the cannabis industry. We really look forward to highlighting all of these entrepreneurs and all of these amazing businesses that are throughout the supply chain right there at Hempton Humanity.
We were talking to Tamika Dunkley, Executive Director for Seasoned Gifts, about the Spring Hudson Valley Cannabis Rollout Call and Supply Chain event. The event is happening on April 25th. Tamika, thank you so much for talking to me about this event, and I hope to talk to you again in the future about the cannabis industry in the Hudson Valley.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having us on and for highlighting this very unique event.
We'll be right back. We talked to Meg McGuire, publisher of Delaware Currents, about her recent trip to Philadelphia and where she met up with over 1,000 environmental journalists. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
On the next Radiolab, when you think about abortion,
the Supreme Court has now overturned Roe v. Wade.
There's so much noise around it.
Abortion is murder.
Politics.
Trigger ban after
religion. Emotions. But there's a much quieter note amidst all of that noise. The sound of science advancing.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Matt Hurtado. Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day, and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm your host for this Tuesday evening, Patricio Robayo. Delaware Currents is a news project that tells the story of the Delaware River, starting from its origin in the Catskill Mountains of New York and flowing all the way down to the Delaware Bay. Recently, Meg McGuire, the publisher of Delaware Currents, co-hosted a conference in Philadelphia, the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference. Is co-hosted with the University of Pennsylvania. This conference brings over 1,000 environmental journalists from USA, Canada, and international to discuss key environmental issues, including the major national debate on fracking and fossil fuels versus renewable sources like wind and solar. Meg, welcome to the program. So what can you tell us about this conference that you attended in? Well, first of all, congratulations on being a co-host for this type of conference, but if you could tell us exactly what this conference was all about and some takeaways that you got from this conference.
SEJ has an annual conference every year. The last one was in Boise, Idaho, and they decide where their conferences are going to be a good year or two in advance. At every conference, there is an academic host. This year, the academic host was the University of Pennsylvania. So we had some of the conference taking place at the Annenberg Centers on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and then some on a nearby hotel, which is where many of the conference participants stayed. About actually a year before the conference, they start looking for people to be co-hosts. They like getting co-hosts from the area that they're going to be holding the conference in, and they offered me that slot, and I was delighted to take it. I must confess, the implication I had was that it would only be about an hour a week until about 2 months before the conference. Oh, that is so not the truth. It was actually a lot of work, but it was also great to be elbow deep in developing the conference because I began to appreciate all the work that environmental journalists are doing. And in a funny sort of way, it was a great to the occasional despair that befalls all of us as journalists, either because the work we do in a general sense in journalism is not listened to and respected for the fact-finding that it is, and then specifically in the area of environmental journalism, there are any numbers of people, organizations, businesses who want to poo the ground truths of climate change and what it means to our country and the world. Having some up-close knowledge of the smarts of the people that are part of this organization was really it lifted me up, I think, a bit. There were over 1,000 journalists at the conference. The conference is largely made up, composed by the SEJ journalists themselves. As we go through this, like all of the panels are suggested by SEJ journalists. Now, there were something like 135 panels suggested by journalists, and part of my job with obviously working with other people who are very familiar with conferences, with SEJ's conferences, was to whittle that down to about 30 panels. So that was an extraordinary task because, honestly, when it comes to a panel on hydrogen and whether the hydrogen is really going to help us with our climate change problems, or is it an expensive boondoggle that sort of takes your eyes off the prize? In order to understand what that panel might present and who its presenters might be, I had to do some research on hydrogen and get a little bit more up to speed on it because, and I think you know, there's a hydrogen proposed for southeast Pennsylvania and northern Delaware. It's one site, but it's also many sites linked in together. So it was important for me to learn more about that. I found as I was going through, there was a lot of work to educate myself on what the panels could be and what would work, but it was also linked up with the fact that there were so many people who were already knowledgeable about this and were doing their best to supply all our readers and listeners with as much up-to-date and accurate information as possible. That was terrific. So we had, as our co-host, as I said, the University of Pennsylvania. And like one of the big overarching themes for this conference was the dangers of mis- and disinformation, especially in this election year and also generally with the onslaught of mis- and disinformation that can flood the zone about anything to do with climate change or sustainability. And there we had two real experts, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who's the director of the Annenberg Public Science Policy Center at Penn, and she is a co-founder of factcheck.org. That's been up and running for quite a few years now. They try as best as possible to check what politicians say and to say, is it true or is it fictitious, right? So she is particularly valuable for all of us who are involved in journalism. And then the other person who is a key person, part of our conference, was Michael Eman, who is the director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media. So he is an expert on climate change and is a science who has a list as long as your arm of books and articles and peer-reviewed stuff. But you might have heard of him because most scientists, when they are given a bad name by these bad actors who want to say that they're lying, he took action. In February of this year, a civil trial jury in Washington found that Mark Stein and the Competitive Enterprise Institute blogger Rand Simberg defamed and injured climatologist Michael Mann in blog post. The jury awarded Mann $1 in compensatory damage from each writer. It awarded punitive damages of $1,000 from Simberg and $1 million from Stein after finding that the pair made their statements with, quote, maliciousness, spite, ill will, vengeance, or deliberate intent to harm. And Michael Mann is among those scientists who are feeling like it's time to get the boxing gloves on and to fight back when people say that what they're saying is untrue. And this was a pretty famous decision that this court took. And so on the very first day of the conference, we have day-long workshops. And one of the day-long workshops is on that mis- and disinformation that we as journalists need to be on guard for with the election and with the advent of AI.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to the publisher of Delaware Currents, talking about the conference that Meg McGuire just came from, the Society of the Environmental Journalists Conference that happened in Philadelphia. So, Meg, what else happened at this conference?
Another workshop on that day was devoted to the policy and practice of looking after two watersheds, the Delaware, our own beloved Delaware, and our neighbor, the Susquehanna, and comparing and contrasting the governance of those watersheds, which is a workshop I would have been delighted to attend, but because of my co-host duties, I was busy running around all over the place, and so I didn't actually end up attending that. Or another fabulous thing that happens in SEJ is we have all-day tours. Buses fan out from, in this case, Philadelphia, going as far as 2 hours away to see some grassroots reality that affect this part of the world. There was a bus that went down to the Chesapeake Bay and talked with experts there about, despite the fact that the Chesapeake Bay has had an ongoing programs to limit the pollution problems, it still has problems. Then another bus went west to learn about Pennsylvania's fossil fuel legacy. Then closer to our part of the world, there was a bus that came up to the Delaware Water Gap and discussed the Tox Island Dam, discussed the taken land from the Indians, and discussed some of the ideas for what might happen to the DWG NRA. And then, of course, the watershed extends way down to the Delaware Bay, and there was a tour that explored the New Jersey side of Delaware Bay and another tour that explored the Delaware side of the Delaware Bay. And then there was another tour that stayed a little closer in sort of Philadelphia, Chester, Camden, and I think Wilmington, that took a deep dive into what are called fence line communities, that's become a shorthand to talk about those communities that are immediately adjacent to highly polluting facilities like fossil fuel infrastructure, industrial parks, or large manufacturing facilities, and that community is directly affected by traffic noise, operation, and, of course, chemical and fossil fuel emissions of the operation. And one of the things that we have discovered over the last 10 years of doing all this work, it is these fence line communities are very largely African American. They are also lower socioeconomic class. So there's a way that industry and perhaps even government takes advantage of people who don't have the wherewithal to fight back, who don't really know what might be coming down the pike with this fenced-in area that's just down their block. So it's one of the things that environmental journalists are becoming more and more sensitive to, that we find out what's there and then help the community understand what is coming and what they can do about it. And then another tour went out to the New Jersey shore, which is a little outside the watershed, but talking about energy in the east, offshore wind, LNG, and this difficult question of who gets to say no to energy development. Because once again, we're very often places that get developed for energy development are these fence line communities. How can we help them not just get dumped on? And so there was 10 of these tourists that went out. They went out all day. There were one bus broke down. Somebody else got caught in a huge traffic snarl. So it became quite an adventure for, let's see, 10 buses, and there was probably 30 people on each bus. So it was quite a number of people that started dragging back to Philly at anywhere from about 4:30 to about 7:30. But they all seemed to have a great time. I think one of the things that's changed a little in environmental journalism coverage, even in the time that I've been running Delaware Currents, which, good Lord, it's almost 9 years now, there was a time when environmental journalists were very concerned, they still are, about the big stories. What is the federal government doing? What is the international community doing? What are we going to do about, oh, yeah, remember the ozone layer? That was a really big deal. So it was these really big mega stories, and sometimes maybe not nearly enough of the local stories, of the grassroots story. And I think what's happened now is that most people are realizing no matter where you live, there are some effects of climate change, right? Whether it's invasive species or in our neck of the woods, certainly flooding is an issue. So all of these things are happening at a much more local level. When the SDJ conference folks fan out in our area, they're discovering what those local stories are for us, and then seeing how, whether if they're from Montana or Indiana or Ohio, what are the stories that they could write about that perhaps will inform their communities? And what can they listen to hear the voice of the local communities that are experiencing these problems? And so it's a lot, it's like the whole environmental journalist community has become much more attentive to those local effects and therefore writing stories about local effects. And it is, I think, those local effects that are, in a way, our undisputed proof that climate change is real and happening. So it's nice to have those effects to fall back on.
And that does it for the local edition. Thank you so much to my first guest, Tamika Dunkley, about the Spring Hudson Valley Cannabis Roll Call and Supply Chain Spotlight event. And we were just talking to Meg McGuire, publisher of Delaware Currents. If you want more of that interview with Meg McGuire, you can check our website, wjffradio.org. Thank you for listening. Have a good night. Have a good night, Lucy. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.com.